From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty reporting. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled 5-4 upholding President Donald Trump's limited travel ban targeting several Muslim-majority countries and rejecting the view that it violated the Constitution and religious discrimination.
The ruling shows that all of the attacks from the media and the Democrat politicians are wrong, and they turned out to be very wrong. And what we're looking for as Republicans, I can tell you, is strong borders, no crime.
Mr. Trump said the ban is necessary to protect the country against militant attacks, and so is the wall that is to be built along the U.S.-Mexico border.
We started the wall. We're spending a lot of energy and a lot of time, and started up in San Diego and other places. It's under construction now. We have $1.6 billion. But we're going to ask for an increase in wall spending so we can finish it quicker.
The president's political opponents joined rights groups in denouncing the ruling, including this protester at a New York City rally.
We may have a Supreme Court that decided to rule this way, but God is on our side, and we will get through this, my sisters and brothers.
The ruling affirmed broad presidential discretion over who is allowed to enter the U.S. The high court also blocked a California state law requiring clinics that counsel women against abortion to notify clients of the availability of abortions paid by the state. The U.N. mission to Mali Tuesday said Malian troops are part of a multinational anti-jihadist force, executed 12 civilians in May in a reprisal for the death of a soldier. Mali's government last week acknowledged some soldiers were implicated in rights abuses. And U.N. rights investigators say security forces in Democratic Republic of Congo committed atrocities that amount to war crimes. This is VOA News. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani has appealed for national unity as protests and strikes erupted in Tehran and elsewhere over deteriorating economic conditions, conditions that analyst Benham Bentaleblou of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies called dire, citing little change to the country's economic infrastructure.
And what happens is you have lots of classes suffering, you have a squeezed middle class, you have a dying private sector, and you have the bazaar, which led the strikes yesterday and today, gasping for life.
U.S. sanctions are expected to be reimposed after President Donald Trump withdrew from the Iran nuclear agreement. Meanwhile, Washington is warning countries that buy Iranian oil to stop doing so by November. Pro-regime forces in Syria pursued an offensive in the rebel-held south, prompting tens of thousands of civilians to flee as an assault on the city of Daraa begins. Jens Lerke is with the UN.
Civilian infrastructure has also reportedly been attacked and damaged, including an airstrike on Sunday the 24th of June that took a field hospital in the town of Al-Khraq out of function.
The region near Jordanian and Israeli territory has been under a de-escalation agreement. Jordan said its border will remain closed to any more Syrian refugees. The rights group Amnesty International said senior military officials in Myanmar, also known as Burma, should face trial for crimes against humanity over the treatment of Rohingya Muslims. It called on the UN Security Council to refer the matter to the International Criminal Court. Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa said national elections will go on peacefully next month, despite a weekend blast at a ruling campaign rally, a ruling party campaign rally, in which he narrowly escaped injury. Two died, dozens were wounded, including Vice President Constantino Chiwenga. There's been no claim of responsibility. The ballot is scheduled to take place July 30. The Dutch Upper House Tuesday approved a law banning the wearing of face-covering veils in public buildings, not on the street. It includes burkas, niqabs, motor helmets, and ski masks. A welcome move to Freedom Party Senator Marjolein Faber van der Kloorhorst.
Because this is the first step to de-Islamize the Netherlands. And we think it's necessary because we want to protect our civilization and Western freedoms. And so this is the first step. And the next step is to close all the mosques in the Netherlands.
Supporters say it aimed at making schools, hospitals, and public transport safer. Argentina managed to make the World Cup's final 16, beating Nigeria Tuesday 2-1. Croatia defeated Iceland 2-1. And two British Columbia men have been sentenced to house arrest Tuesday for having multiple wives. CBC News said it could be Canada's first conviction for polygamy in more than a century.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, and today is Wednesday, June the 27th, and here are some of the stories we're covering for you. A high-level delegation from Eritrea is in neighboring Ethiopia for historic talks that could bring an end to one of Africa's longest-running conflicts. Eritrean President Isaias Afwerki pledged to send a delegation last week during his country's Mother's Day observance in the capital, Asmara. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, who welcomed the Eritrean delegation, announced, among others, that the Ethiopian Airlines would restart flights to Eritrea for the first time since 1998. And the government of Burundi passed a new budget. In it, the government allocated $18 million to fully fund, for the first time in the country's history, its general elections slated for 2020.
To try to oblige citizens to contribute to elections which are very bad prepared, we have no guarantee that they will be inclusive, transparent, and democratic one.
Tassien Sibomana is an opposition leader in Burundi. And thousands of Nigerian refugees who fled violence from the Boko Haram insurgency for Cameroon said that they are uncertain about returning to their country. And the leaders of Rwanda, Uganda, and Kenya reaffirmed their commitment to advancing regional integration and the need to accelerate socio-economic transformation in the region.
Our respective governments have been implementing various projects that are at different stages of completion. I would like to reaffirm my resolve to work with each one of you to ensure our dream of a globally competitive East Africa is realized for posterity.
That is President Uhuru Kenyatta of Kenya speaking at the summit of the Northern Corridor Integration Project. The project is a multilateral development initiative established in 2013 to speed up development in the region. Those stories plus the World Cup update are coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. A high-level delegation from Eritrea is in neighboring Ethiopia for historic talks that could bring an end to one of Africa's longest-running conflicts. The Eritrean delegation was welcomed to Addis Ababa by Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. Eritrean President Isaias Afwerki pledged to send the delegation last week during his country's Mother's Day observance in the capital, Asmara. President Afwerki's pledge was in response to one made earlier this month by Ethiopia's new Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, that he will honor a deal signed in 2000 to end a border conflict between the two nations. Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed said that Ethiopian Airlines will restart flights to Eritrea for the first time since 1998. The government of Burundi has passed a new budget that allocated more than $18 million for the 2020 general elections. The move comes after European Union and the U.S. suspended direct aid to the government, citing gross human rights violations. For more on this story, Moses Havyarimana reports from Burundi's capital, Bujumbura.
As Burundi is set to fully fund for the first time the country's general elections that is slated for 2020, the government has allocated more than $18 million as part of the contribution to the estimated $30 million of the general elections. While presenting a report of the May referendum to the parliament, the chairman of the Burundi Electoral Commission, Pierre Cravenda Icharie, said that his commission spent at least $15 million on organizing the referendum. He says that the success of the May referendum are the fruits that Burundians are seeing today and will see in future, and that the financing of the elections should be an obligation for every country in order to promote democracy and development. Last month, Burundi conducted a referendum that saw the amendment of the country's 2005 constitution, scrapping presidential term limits that limited the president to not run for more than two terms of 5 years in the office. Last year, Burundi government called on the citizens to voluntarily contribute to the 2020 general elections. However, the move was criticized by the opposition, saying that citizens were forced to contribute, as every household is supposed to contribute at least $1 every year. Tassien Sibomana is an opposition leader in Burundi.
As usual, we condemn that contribution because the poverty is the big problem now from Burundians. So to try to oblige citizens to contribute to elections which are very bad prepared, we have no guarantee that they will be inclusive, transparent and democratic one.
Burundi's economy is currently struggling to stabilize, with a report from the East African Community indicating that the country's economic growth was at 1% last year. Nestor Ndabashinze is a professor at a university in Burundi.
Citizens are already tired. They have already contributed for 6 months because the civil servants whose contributions are deducted from their salaries. The money is supposed to come from inside. I mean, the government is not counting on the foreign aid due to the suspension of cooperation.
Burundi President Pierre Nkurunziza earlier this month announced that he will not contest for the 2020 presidential elections after the end of his 15 years in the office. If he doesn't contest in 2020, he will be the first Burundi democratically elected president to hand over power peacefully. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
Thank you, Moses. And from Bujumbura, we go to Nairobi, Kenya, where three East African leaders have reaffirmed their commitment to advancing regional integration while highlighting the importance of accelerating socio-economic transformation, industrialization, and employment creation. Speaking in Kenya's capital, Nairobi, during the 14th Summit on the Northern Corridor Integration Projects, NCIP, President Uhuru Kenyatta of Kenya, Yoweri Museveni of Uganda, and Paul Kagame of Rwanda agreed to allocate more funding for implementation and sustainability of NCIP projects. From Nairobi, Kenya, Maureen Ojiambo has more on this story.
The summit was aimed at enhancing the regional infrastructure, trade, immigration, security, among other key issues that are affecting the eastern region. Speaking during the summit, Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta highlighted the immense benefits of the joint interventions initiated under the Northern Corridor Integration Project since its inception in 2013. President Kenyatta further assured his regional colleagues that Kenya will sustain the momentum in the timely implementation of the remaining phases of the Standard Gauge Railway to reach the Kenya-Uganda border town of Malaba.
Our respective governments have been implementing various projects that are at different stages of completion. I would like to reaffirm my resolve to work with each one of you to ensure our dream of a globally competitive East Africa is realized for posterity. The security of our region, excellencies, is also critical, especially during this era clouded with threats of terrorism. And we remain committed to the implementation of the Mutual Defense Pact and the Mutual Peace and Security Cooperation Pact. These instruments remain our guide in the development of implementation mechanisms with respect to ensuring our region is secure for both local as well as international investors.
On the other hand, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni said that he is optimistic that the Ugandan economy will be boosted through support from the neighboring countries led by Kenya that buy its excess produce such as maize and milk. Museveni, who apologized for the harm Uganda has caused Kenyans, also urged Ugandan Revenue Authority officials based at the port of Mombasa to work hard and for long hours like their counterparts in Kenya to ensure that there is no backlog of cargo destined to Uganda at the port.
I want to apologize on behalf of these wonderful people, the Ugandans. They are causing a lot of inconvenience to our Kenyan brothers. Since President Uhuru came into government, he has moved. Things are moving very quickly from Mombasa. But Uganda Revenue Authority only work for half a day and they go to sleep. So that's why I'm not apologizing on their behalf, because, you know, Ugandans are not easily embarrassed. But I'm sure they are going to wake up and start working for 24 hours. This line going to Kigali, to Mirama Hill, which delayed and frustrated our brothers and sisters in Rwanda. They say now they are threatening now to finish it. They say it is now 75% finished. It seems it's going to be finished now.
Museveni's apology to Kenyans comes a day after the Ugandan security officer stormed the kindergarten school in Migingo Island and closed it on grounds that the island does not belong to Kenya and that no structure should be put up Migingo Island has been scrambled for by Kenya and Uganda for decades now as the two states failed to settle on the ownership. On his part, Rwandan President Paul Kagame said the reconvening of the summit after nearly 2 years will keep up the momentum in fashioning and implementing joint initiatives and projects for the benefit of the region.
May continue with the momentum that we had started for our region, bringing it together and working on different projects, again jointly, for the benefit of our region and our people. Also, the fact that we had made even headways in bringing together governments, the business people and investors, local and from abroad.
In attendance were representatives of Tanzania, Burundi, Ethiopia and Democratic Republic of Congo as observers. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Moreno Jambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
Zimbabwe's political parties signed a peace pledge committing to peaceful campaigns for the July 30th general election. From Zimbabwe's capital, Harare, reporter Sebastian Mofu has more on this.
Zimbabwe's political parties sing the national anthem before signing a, quote, peace pledge, unquote, which the Zimbabwe National Peace and Reconciliation Commission says is aimed at ending violence that characterized the country's previous elections. Absent from the ceremonies Tuesday, where the two leading candidates for the July 30th election, President Emmerson Mnangagwa of the ruling ZANU-PF party and Nelson Chamisa, the leader of the Movement for Democratic Change Alliance, a coalition of opposition parties. MDC Alliance Secretary General Douglas Monzora said the candidates were represented by party leaders.
So the national chairpersons of political parties are key people in the maintenance of peace within the political party, and they are also key people in the inter-party relations. And we hope that this will be more organic. We will build the national trust that is necessary. For a long time, our politics was enmeshed in toxic issues of hate, intimidation, violence, corruption, and subterfuge. We hope this signing ceremony brings a new era and a new politics to our country.
Zimbabwe Home Affairs Minister Obed Mpofu, who represented Mnangagwa, commented on the peace pledge.
To us, it confirms what we have been saying, what our president has been saying about the conduct of electioneering and mobilization of people towards our harmonized elections, that they should be peaceful, free of violence, and credible, without really, any impediment of other people's rights. So we are quite happy that this pledge has been signed by, or is going to be signed by, those who aspire for peace in our conduct for elections.
Police dragged the leader of the 1980 Freedom Movement Party, Francis Tana, out of the ceremony for protesting that the July 30th elections are a sham unless the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission resigns.
We should not go and participate in an election which is rigged, which is flawed. We should not go on and participate in an election which we know they are already the whistleblowers and their biased. We should not allow a flawed process. I'm not talking as a person who is intending to win any election. I'm talking as a person, as a responsible citizen. We should have a message which will teach our children and our children's children that the election can let a leader Zimbabwe Unita say. The how part of it is what we're supposed to clearly answer in 2018.
Opposition parties have long accused the ruling ZANU-PF party of manipulating the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission to ensure victory at the polls. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
And thousands of Nigerian refugees who fled violence from the Boko Haram insurgency for Cameroon say that they are uncertain about returning to their country because they have lost everything to the insurgents. Humanitarian officials say conditions for refugee children may worsen if the youngsters continue to avoid school in the Minawawa refugee camp. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports that more than half of the thousands of children there either stay home or are involved with child labor.
It is a very noisy morning at the Minawawa refugee camp in northern Cameroon. Groups of people are making rounds, calling on refugees to keep sending their young children to a formal educational establishment or teenagers to vocational schools to learn a trade that will help them should they voluntarily return to Nigeria. Sister Gift Slovanska is a Roman Catholic nun who helps the refugees in far northern Cameroon. She says the UNHCR, along with the NGO Plan International and local non-governmental organizations, churches and traditional rulers, aim to stress the importance of an education for children.
Nous avons les parents qui sont très bien. Ils nous ont donné les enfants.
She says it is rather unfortunate that in spite of their tours of the refugee camps to tell parents to send their children to school, some still allow their children to serve as household help and child workers in surrounding villages just because they lack food. In March 2017, the governments of Cameroon and Nigeria, alongside the UN Refugee Agency, signed an agreement for the voluntary repatriation of Nigerian refugees living in Cameroon. More than 85,000 refugees who fled the Boko Haram insurgency in northeastern Nigeria are living at the Minawawa camp. 16,000 children were registered in schools before 2017, but after the announcement of their possible return to Nigeria, the numbers dropped to 7,000 this year, according to Cameroon's government. Elvis Ngabihina is a spokesperson for traditional leaders who educate the refugees about sending children to school in the northern regions of Cameroon. He says the response has not been very successful this year because some 60% of the refugees are anxious to return home. He says the main problem they face is that 80% of the population of the Minawawa refugee camp is made up of school-age children, but that a majority of them have been absent from classrooms, especially when they started hoping about returning to Nigeria. Cameroon, Nigeria, and the UNHCR agreed to provide people wishing to return with clear information on the security and economic situation, as well as access to basic services, particularly in Borno, Yobe, and Adamawa states in northeastern Nigeria, where Boko Haram fighting is historically violent, in order to allow refugees to make well-informed and voluntary decisions. This month, George Akos Obo, the UN Refugee Agency's Assistant High Commissioner for Operations, visited Minawawa and said officials would observe the situation in Nigeria before advising the refugees to voluntarily return home.
It is clear that in those areas in which there are still activities that threaten safety, where people are being attacked, where people are being abducted, where their property is being destroyed, being burnt, and where there are security operations which are ongoing to resolve this problem, those are not conditions where people can return.
Akos Obo said while waiting, the international community should know that the main goal to strive for is education. A 2016 UNHCR survey conducted in Minawawa camp revealed that 71% of the refugees intend to return as soon as the situation is conducive to doing so. Boko Haram is blamed for about 20,000 deaths since beginning its insurgency in northern Nigeria in 2009. The Islamist extremist group says it wants to create a strict Islamic state in Muslim-majority northern Nigeria. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Minawau, Northern Cameroon.
World leaders in forest conservation are meeting in Oslo this week to determine ways to combat deforestation all around the world. Home to some of the world's most threatened forests, certain African countries will have a role in the spotlight at the event. Frances Semoa is a forestry expert at the World Resources Institute, and she speaks to Ricky Shryock about the issues that will particularly impact the region.
There's going to be a session on the role of peatlands and mangroves and conserving them as part of climate mitigation strategies. And in light of the recent appreciation of the extensive peatlands in the Congo Basin, for example, that session is going to be relevant to Africa. There are some sessions that have a particular African focus. For example, there's going to be a panel on the relationship between indigenous rights and the climate and forest agenda. We have another panel on defending environmental defenders, and that will include a panelist, Rodrigue Katembo, who's a park ranger from Virunga National Park in the DRC.
What kind of goals do you guys have for this conference in terms of real impact on the ground?
One is, as I said before, to raise awareness of the importance of forest issues in meeting agreed goals related to climate change mitigation and adaptation and achieving the sustainable development goals in particular country contexts. We'll also have a number of sessions that focus on the role of commodity supply chains for commodities such as palm oil that tend to cause deforestation. And as you may know, I think it's some 10 countries in West and Central Africa have signed up to the Africa Palm Oil Initiative to see if they can do palm oil development in a way that doesn't come at the expense of forests.
That was Frances Seymour, a forestry expert at the World Resources Institute. She was speaking to reporter Ricky Shryock from the East Coast of the United States. And now for some World Cup news with Samson O'Malley after a tough day for Nigerian soccer fans. Good morning, Samson.
Good morning, Jackson. We're super good, but Nigeria lost the opportunity to play in the second round of the 2018 FIFA World Cup after losing to Argentina in a match that had all the dramatic sights to meet at the St. Petersburg Stadium in Russia. The Super Eagles lost in the 14th minute when Lionel Messi, through a defensive error, got the opener for the Argentines. The Super Eagles came back in the second half to level scoring through a penalty that was scored by Victor Moses, and it took defender Marcus Rojo to get the winner for the Argentines. Diego Maradona, who was at the VIP stand at the stadium, had to be rushed to the hospital after he had some medical attention following a series of emotions he went through in the course of the game. In the other Group D match, Croatia was able to gain the maximum points after beating Iceland by 2-1. In the group, they'll go into the second round alongside Argentina, who qualified from the group. One of the major highlights of Tuesday's matches is a match involving Peru and Australia, where Peru defeated Australia by 2-0. That was their first World Cup win in over 40 years. As the match gets into the second round, the only hope for Africa will be on Senegal as they take on their perennial rivals as they hope to fly Africa's flag, hoping to get the maximum points that will take them through into the second round of the competition. From St. Petersburg here in Russia, Samson O'Malley. It's back to Jackson in Washington.
Thank you very much, Samson. And that's it for this Wednesday, June the 27th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good day, Africa.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, decentralized systems of governments in Africa. In Uganda, it's called decentralization. In Kenya, devolution. in Nigeria and Ethiopia, it's called federalism, the transfer of authority from central to local government on the next Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.